Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit DartmouthHitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It was a storm like no one in New England had ever seen, the hurricane of 1938, which hit the region right as fall was beginning, pounding the coast and ripping inland through Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Vermont, and New Hampshire. A film produced by the federal government described the destruction.
September 21st in mid-afternoon, this tropical terror struck, swept over outer Long Island, swept into thickly settled, highly developed New England. Struck with winds roaring 100, 150, almost 200 miles an hour. Tidal waves 30 to 40 feet high struck a section unprepared.
But while much of the attention was focused on the coast and the cities, now a new book reminds us that this was a rural tale as well. New Hampshire forests and the communities that depended upon them were hugely affected. Countless numbers of trees were blown down here, and their epic story of their sudden mass toppling is rivaled only by the equally epic saga of how it was all cleaned up. Today in The Exchange, the lesser-known side of a dramatic storm, how the hurricane of 38 hit rural New England, and what we've learned from this weather event for the next time. Let's hear from you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests for the hour. Stephen Long is here, author of the new book called 38, The Hurricane That Transformed New England. Stephen Long is also founder and former editor of Northern Woodlands Magazine. And Stephen, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Also with us, Stu Wallace, professor of history at New Hampshire Technical Institute. And Stu, welcome back. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Stu, I want you to just start, please, by setting the stage for us. New England, 1938, you know, the Great Depression. We're not quite involved in World War II yet. What was New England like at that time?
Well, we had been clobbered by the Depression. Our rural areas had, particularly farms, had been clobbered, but then that was a national story, and they'd been clobbered since World War I. As far as our other industries, we'd relied heavily on textile manufacturing. Those actually were in serious, serious trouble. Our big mills in New Hampshire had all more or less either shut down or were on a rump labor force by 1935. And so New England was struggling to find itself. Unemployment was particularly high in the cities, and in rural areas it was poor. The farms tended to be poor. They were struggling to come up with something they'd never really done well since sheep farming had begun to peter out right after the Civil War. And it was a relatively poor area. Unemployment was, as if they measured it in any degree, was fairly high. And people were struggling to make a living. Sometimes people would have sort of a mixed bag of an agricultural job and a forestry job and a job in retail. They were doing anything they could to survive. And it's interesting because we actually, even though we had Republican governors, did jump heavily into New Deal programs because we realized that without federal help, like especially CCC, we were the first state to actually fill our quota in CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps. Without that kind of help, we would have been in much worse shape.
So the farms had, big farms had long since migrated out to the Midwest, Stu. The textile mills, that work had migrated down south.
Right.
And then there's a national depression on. So it sounds like New England at this time was not in great shape.
No, northern New England was not in great shape. And they had the farms themselves had to a large degree, and this is part of the problem, had actually been reforesting for some time. They had just been left to grow their own way back. That by itself was problematic.
Well, and that's key, isn't it, Stephen Long, to this story, these changes in the landscape, farming and forestry altering the northern New England landscape. It's important because this affects how the hurricane hits non-coastal New England. Just describe, Stephen, please, how farming and forestry had changed things so much by that point in time, 1938.
Sure. So New Hampshire had really stopped farming for the most part in the time around the Civil War. So one of the things that happens when you abandon farmland is that trees grow back. And we don't have to plant trees in New England. They just grow. And white pine tends to be the tree that comes in on abandoned farmland. So New Hampshire had been growing trees and cutting trees since, say, the 1880s. The forestry up until that point had been clearing land for agriculture. At that point in the 1880s and onward, there suddenly was the opportunity for an industry. So,
a forestry industry.
A forestry industry.
People have given
industry.
Up on farming. Forget it. If we're
right.
serious about this, we'll go to Ohio or Indiana. But
right.
we can grow trees here.
Right. And pine grows relatively quickly. You can, start to finish 40 years, you have a pine tree that you can harvest. So New Hampshire was set up for this hurricane in incredible way of having more pine standing tall than it had ever had before.
And why is that so important, pine, versus any other kind of tree like maple or oak or whatever?
Pine stands tall at 40, 60 years. It's a very, very tall tree. It's a fast-growing tree. And it's shallow-rooted and easier to uproot. Hardwoods grow more slowly, take more time to get to the stature where where they're vulnerable. And so in Vermont, for instance, the Vermonters kept farming much longer. There was farming going on through the 30s. And so what happened in Vermont was largely sugar orchards blew down in 38. In New Hampshire, it was pine. 98% of the trees that went down in New Hampshire were white pine.
Wow. And okay, and it's significant because A, they're tall, so they can make lots of destruction, and B,
right.
as you said, shallow rooted, so it doesn't take much to topple the whole thing over, root ball and all.
Exactly.
Let's take some calls, gentlemen. Again, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we explore another side of this dramatic hurricane of 38. A new book looks at how it hit rural New England, especially the forests and farms of this region. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And from Nottingham, Steve is on the air. Thanks for calling in, Steve. Go ahead.
Good morning. And I've always been fascinated by the hurricane of 1938 because as a kid, when I was going to Hebrew school, I would go into Middletown, Connecticut, and there was a marker where the Connecticut River was so high. So it's always been a big event in New England. But what I want to get to is the background of the hurricane. First, it came up the coast, and it wasn't really detected. People were not paying attention to it, so it struck when people didn't know what was going to happen. But what's more important is that before it struck, there was days of rain. So it was a unique hurricane in the sense that it gained speed over land. Normally, they die out when they hit land. But because the ground was so saturated, it hit went right through Connecticut, Massachusetts, into New Hampshire with a much ferocious force than normally would have occurred.
Yeah, and that's actually a really important point. Steve, thank you so much for calling in. And Stephen Long, he's right. The hurricane might not have been so bad, but it was preceded by 3 days of rain.
Yeah, that's the thing that people have lost in discussion of the hurricane. So that's a great point that Steve made. So if the separate entity of this hurricane coming up the coast had not happened, it would have been known as the flood of 38. It was flooded throughout New Hampshire and in southern New England as well. And then so this hurricane comes up. And I want to step back for just 1 second on this. And people in New England did not ever expect a hurricane. It did not happen in New England. It had been almost 70 years since a hurricane had hit even southern New England. So northern New England was just, this does not happen. They had no, they didn't know what it was. They literally did not know what hit them.
Could you talk about that too, Stu, that people in New England just thought that's a southern thing, we don't need to worry about that?
Well, yeah, they wouldn't have thought about hurricanes. We didn't have all the satellite imagery and all that stuff, so they might have heard about a big storm to the south and thought, well, that's their problem. It took a track that hurricanes aren't supposed to take. And I think Stephen makes a good point at the end in saying, well, yeah, it's really unusual and it may not happen for another 100 years or it might happen this year.
Yeah.
You can't predict. And there are a series of meteorological events that somehow sent this one the wrong direction, right up the Connecticut Valley.
Well, what was the state of meteorology back then, Stu? I mean, people must have had some inkling that it was coming.
Only they'd heard about a big storm, and they didn't realize that. Even if they had heard the word hurricane, which they probably hadn't, they would not have assumed it would have hit this in the interior of New Hampshire or Vermont. That just didn't happen. And it had. Stephen points out there were a couple of storms that hit earlier, but I don't think too many people remembered 1635 or 36, whatever. And so that just wasn't known.
Wow. Yeah, so no one alive. Yeah, go ahead.
1815 was the only other Category 2 hurricane that ever hit New Hampshire. So that was, 120-some-odd years before. And so, it was just not in anyone's consciousness.
Go ahead, Stu.
I think more people were worried about the flood side because we had had 2 years earlier probably the worst floods in our history. We had major floods, 1896, 1927, 1936. And so it was the flood that worried people the most of anything. And we did have some dams go on this one. So the flood side of it was something they were fearful of. They just didn't understand the wind side of it.
I see. So they didn't have that experience with it. So here the ground is very soft. This wind comes ripping through, and that makes the impact even worse than, it might have been, Stephen.
That's right. 100-mile-an-hour winds, I don't think any of us have ever experienced that. And so you have saturated ground and 100-mile-an-hour winds that are ripping through an area over a period of 5 hours. Very, very fast-moving storm. Most hurricanes just sort of poke along. That's why they dump a whole bunch of rain. They're just moving very slowly, 10, 15 miles an hour. This one, boom, 50 miles an hour. One of the nicknames of it is the Long Island Express, which is not just because it hit Long Island, but because it was so fast.
Well, here's another clip from the short film Shock Troops of Disaster, produced by the Works Projects Administration about the storm and the recovery effort. And we'll talk about the federal agencies that were involved in the cleanup in a minute. But here the narrator just describes some of the damage that both of you talked about, the floods and so forth.
On the watersheds of New England, the storm brought new torrents to rivers already gorged after 3 days downpour. And so flood was added to the burden of the hurricane. Sweeping down from their headwaters in the high mountains, swirling rivers rose to levels rivaling the disastrous floods of 1936, increasing the difficulty of removing refugees and of carrying food and help into the stricken area.
Again, the number for you to join us here in the Exchange as we look back at the hurricane of 38, especially how it transformed rural New England, 1-800-892-6477. Your questions and comments are welcome, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. So, guys, the hurricane hits, and Stephen Long, how fast does it scream in and scream out? A lot of people in your book describe it as very fast.
Yes. Yeah, so in any one place, it would have been start to finish, it would have taken 5 hours. The peak of it would have been sort of early in that 5 hours and probably about an hour's worth of just really, really intense wind. The highest wind that was recorded was over in Milton, Mass., outside of Boston, and that was 186 miles an hour, and it destroyed their wind meter. So that was the highest. And if you think,
wait, it destroyed their wind meter?
Yeah, So 186
wow.
was all it could handle, and so who knows? It was probably considerably more than that. But so that was the gusts, and that was considerably east of here. And so you can get a picture. The track went up over the Green Mountains in Vermont. So if you think the winds all the way out to the east, all the way out to Boston are 186 miles an hour, that's quite a wide swath.
Stu, you've been following New Hampshire history for a long time. What do old timers, how do they remember this storm?
Well, it's interesting because you'd think, well, there aren't many around. There are. They were probably children at the time it hit.
Small children.
Yes, and they were totally they were mystified by it. All their own parents were mystified by it. There are stories about people rushing around trying to save various the farm stories, particularly people trying to save livestock. Forget the chickens. The chickens really get wiped out on this one. One of the problems you hear about on the farms is the fact that what few farms we had that were trying to make a living had switched over to poultry.
Oh,
now,
dear.
You don't need to be an architectural historian to know that probably the feeblest structure on any farm was the hen house. They were just all flattened.
Wow.
Many barns were crippled. And so kids will talk about the fact that the house would shake, and their parents were extremely worried and concerned about the whole thing, but they didn't know what was going on either.
Well, I bet that's a memory that just sears in your mind forever. Yeah, how hard was it, Stephen, to get older New Englanders to talk about this? You had a hard time.
Well, I didn't have a hard time at all. One person I had a hard time with, and I talk about him in the book. This is a huge event in their lives, and so it meant so much, and it meant so much to be able to talk about it. The fellow who was reticent is just so interesting. I mean, he went through the storm. The storm blew down all around him while he was on his way back home. He hid under a pine tree. And I said, "Well, Fred, weren't you scared?" He said, "Scared? What would I be scared of? All the trees just blew down." And I thought, "Oh my God, I can't believe that he's not going to tell me more than this."
Here he is hiding under a fallen tree,
right,
with trees crashing down around him.
Yeah.
But he's
yeah.
not scared because, you know, he's got his tree and he's protected.
I guess.
Let's take another call, guys. And this is Ken in Antrim. Hi, Ken. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. I work with the elderly, and I worked with a guy named, I called him Mr. Ed, and he lived in Waltham, Mass. In the 30s, and he was after a science fair, and he made his own barometer. He brought it into school, and they told him to demonstrate it and show him, and the teacher said, "Okay, what are we going to have for weather tomorrow?" And he went, "A hurricane." And they all laughed, and the teacher went, "Oh, yeah, right." And so they went home, and they had the hurricane, and the next day, he was very proud, and he was the child weather boy.
Wow.
The state of Massachusetts.
I hope he got an A-plus on that science report. So he predicted a hurricane, and as our guests were saying earlier, Ken, everybody at the time thought, "Nah, we don't get those. That's a southern thing or a tropical thing."
Well, I almost drowned in Hurricane Gloria swimming in the ocean like a stupid person that I was.
Wow. All right. Well, Ken, thank you for calling in. I love that story, and it kind of gets back to what you talked about earlier, Stephen.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah, it's that the barometers would just plummeted. One of the interesting things about the reason that people up here didn't know about it was the Weather Service had done such a good job of scaring people down in Florida that all of the ships at sea were avoiding the area. And so the way that they used to track hurricanes was they would be in radio contact with ships, and they would tell them what the barometric pressure was, and they would tell them about the winds and what direction it came from. And so when this storm was aiming at Florida, the Weather Service was so diligent about warning people that the ships all were either in port or way out to sea, nowhere where they could tell radio in and let people know about it. And so what they normally expect a storm like that to do is recurve out into the ocean, head north and then head northeast. This one,
back
instead of doing
sea.
That, boom, went just straight absolutely north and slammed into us totally unawares.
Well, we'll talk more in just a moment. More memories, questions, comments about the hurricane of 38, especially how it affected rural northern New England. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the hurricane of 38. It's been called the hurricane that transformed New England. We're looking at that and how its impacts can still be seen in the forests and landscape of northern New England. A new book tells the story more from a rural perspective. It's called 38, the hurricane that transformed New England. Author Stephen Long is with us, along with Stu Wallace, professor of history at New Hampshire Technical Institute. We're taking your questions, comments, remembrances, stories about the hurricane of 38 this hour in The Exchange. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, just before the break, we were talking about how people of that generation remembered the storm. Many of them, Stu Wallace, you said, were young children. Here's a memory that you took down in your book, Stephen Long. This is a memory from Harry Brainerd of Corinth, Vermont. Again, written in your book, Harry was 12 when the storm hit his family's farm. This reading is voiced by NHPR volunteer George Calder with a little fiddle music by Vi Wickham.
We ate supper and the wind just kept getting worse. Then we looked out and our barn doors were going out across the field, end over end. It took the doors right off the big barn. About then, the first tree went and came right on the doorstep. My mother had just come in. She'd got the washing in from the clothesline, and then the pine and spruce started hitting the house. And when they hit the ridgepole, they broke right off, and the top part of the tree slid down the other side. It just got so that every time one of them huge trees struck the house just jumped right up and down. I remember my father said, and my mother too, I guess we'll be starting over again. We figured the barns would probably be demolished and everything.
Well, and Stu Wallace, that gives you a sense of just the destruction of these rural New England farms. And he hit it right on the head. I guess we'll have to start over. The economic impact of this must have been huge for these New England farmers who, by the way, were not rich to begin with.
No, I was going to say, if they could start over again, that's and the cleanup effort, all that was really, we weren't prepared for any of this. We didn't have safety nets other than New Deal programs, which by good luck were here at the time. And as a result, it was a disaster. I mean, roads were shut down, communication was shut down. If they had to start all over again, they're the only ones who knew it because they had no way of letting anybody else know what their plight was. Everything was shut down.
Yeah, communication was really...
We used ham radio operators. Were about the only good communication we had for a while. Those guys could get some messages out, but the average person couldn't send them or receive them.
So. Well, how would a person like that family start over, to use their words, Stu? I mean, again, they'd lost everything, and you're in the middle of a depression. So how do you even start over?
A lot of them sold.
Really?
They had to sell out. Some of them did. I mean, they were already... marginalized and not making much money anyway. And with the loss, say, of poultry, that was a disaster. New England farming was not doing well at this time. Some dairy farms were doing okay in New Hampshire, much better, I think, in Vermont. Vermont always kept its farms in better shape than New Hampshire. So.
You mentioned that in the book, actually, the difference between New Hampshire and Vermont, Stephen Long, and economically, they were farming more than we were here in New Hampshire. So the landscape was different, and that affected how the storm affected those two states. Talk about the difference between the two and why that's so important.
Sure. So New Hampshire was 80% forested at that time, Vermont more like 50%. So there were fewer trees to blow down. But the trees that were there tended to be parts of sugar orchards. And
this is in Vermont.
In Vermont, yeah. And so Vermont farmers relied tremendously on the income from sugar orchards. Every spring they made enough money to pay a hired man for the year. So this was not just pin money. This was real, real money that made it possible for them to keep on farming. So while when someone's woodlot blew down and that was sort of their woodland bank account, that's one thing. But then losing a source of income was tremendously devastating to Vermont farmers. And so sugar production went way, way down in the wake of the hurricane. And people, as Stu just suggested, people got out at that point. And so it was one more nail in the coffin of farming in Vermont. And so in the time since the 1938 hurricane, Vermont has gotten to be 75% forested. So it's taken only that time. And I'm not saying that the hurricane was the only thing, but it was a crucial event in the life of these farmers.
Well, here's an email that just came in from someone who has memories of it from a relative. This person says, my mother-in-law was alone on a farm in the Monadnock region with four small children, the youngest of whom was my husband, who was 9 months old. She was huddled in the barn with them, hiding the baby in the corn crib. She had no phone or radio. There was seaweed plastered on the barn. Her husband was a sawyer, so he was out in the woods, and due to all the fallen trees, couldn't get back for quite a while. I remember her telling me that she had no idea what was happening and thought it might be the end of the world.
That's fantastic. That's just incredible.
Well, thank you so much for that email. The person didn't give a name. Seaweed on the barn, Stephen, in the Monadnock region.
Yeah. Well, some of the stories you hear are just mind-boggling. But if you think of a storm coming 50 miles an hour with wind of 100-plus miles an hour and swirling about, it could – various things could be aloft that would find their way in. I heard of tropical birds being found up in northern Vermont and New Hampshire.
Who got blown in by the hurricane?
Yeah, they just got within the system, and it just blew them away. And so, yeah, so seabirds being found in East Corinth, Vermont.
Amazing. All right, let's go back to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Martha's in Lebanon. Hi, Martha, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. I've become one of those old-timers who has a memory of the 1938 hurricane.
Great. Let's hear it, Martha.
We lived just outside of Boston in the community of Brookline, which was just a little small town then. And we had a modest house, but one of the things that distinguished it was a beautiful, tall blue spruce in the front yard. And my father, who was always interested in having us not be frightened of anything of a natural cause, had us go out on the front porch and watch as the tree was bending over. And then, realizing that it was really more than just a light blow, he went out and he staked it up with ropes and pegs. And we all cheered, Dad saved our tree. And then the storm quieted down rather than getting stronger. And after a short interval, I'm not sure what length that was, the wind came up again very forcefully, and it was going in the other direction. And lo and behold, the tree blew down, fortunately away from the house this time, so there was no real damage except for this beautiful tree that we lost, and we were all safe. But the eye of the storm is something very peculiar, because as little children, I don't know how old I was then, maybe four, my brother was three, we didn't know what that was. We thought it was the end of the storm, and we were lulled by that.
Very tricky. Yeah, the eye of the storm. Either of you want to talk about that a little bit, eye of the storm, and how people felt about that or experienced it? Stephen?
Well, sure. What happens is there's a calm in the center of the storm, and so if you're within the eye – it was about a 50-mile radius eye, and you would get winds from one direction when it first comes through. And then as that first eye wall passes you, then there's calm, and so calm that what I heard described was you could light a match, light a cigarette in the middle of that. And so for a period of time, it would have been, if you were right in the middle of that, then it could have been about an hour of calm, and then wind from the other direction, because the wind is cyclonic, so it's going counterclockwise, and so it would have been going from the east when it first hit you, and then it would have been from the west.
Martha, thank you for the call, and let's go next to Wayne in Rumney. Hi, Wayne. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. My memories are not personal memories of the storm itself, but of sitting around a wood stove with an old New Hampshire Yankee named Myron Braley from the town of Hebron, who was at Camp Mowgli as the caretaker, and I went to the camp for many years, and he would tell stories of how so many white pines blew down that you could walk from Route 3 along the side of Newfound Lake for a half a mile down to the lake, just on the tops of the trees that had fallen, on the poles of the trees that had fallen, without ever having to step down and touch the ground.
Wow.
And I believe Camp Mowgli actually rebuilt some of the buildings from the trees that had fallen.
Yeah, Wayne, thank you so much. And the amount of blowdown was just unbelievable, gentlemen. Without getting into bored feet and so forth, Stephen, can you just give us a sense of how many trees or how much wood was lost?
Well, sure. It was. I'm sorry, I do have to get into bored feet, but I'll try to make it understandable. 2.6 billion bored feet. The way that you can picture that is to picture a log truck going down the road, and you're behind it, and you look at that truck, and on that truck is probably about 6,000 board feet. So what blew down in a five-hour period was 430,000 of those log trucks. And so that was about five times what the annual harvest throughout New England was. And so suddenly on the ground is five times what would have been a normal cut. And so the U.S. Forest Service was very, very concerned about this for two reasons. One, they were very worried about the possibility of fire damage. With all of this pine on the ground, they were very concerned that a second disaster would follow on the first and that the region would be up in flames. And then the second, they were worried about all of these 30,000 landowners whose woodland bank accounts were on the ground. And with all of that wood on the ground all at once, if market forces were allowed to prevail, there would have been absolutely no money paid for that, because there was so much of it you would be paying to have this cleaned up. And so the Forest Service developed a program called the Northeast Timber Salvage Administration. It had two arms, one of which was to clean up the brush along roads, in towns, trails, try to recover the capacity to fight fire. And then the other was to salvage the logs. And so the first one, there's a lot of WPA, as we mentioned before, the Works Progress Administration, and the CCC boys were involved in that.
Well, let's talk about that. And just to kick off that discussion about how the federal government got involved in this huge, huge cleanup. And thank you for the call, by the way. This is a clip from the short film Shock Troops of Disaster, produced by the Works Progress Administration, the WPA that you just mentioned, Stephen. About the recovery effort, and here the narrator describes the role of the WPA workers.
In 3 days, an army of 110,000 WPA workers had been shifted to emergency storm and flood duty. Every little man with a pick on this map represents 1,000 workers of the WPA. Manpower turning from regular public improvements and services into the breach in time of dire need. Where tracks remained to carry trains, thousands of these workers came by rail. Shock troops of disaster, someone has called them, because so many times in recent years they have provided the human sinews for great tasks of reconstruction.
Anyway, there it is, Stu Wallace. Shock troops of disaster. Now, most people, Stu, have heard of these Roosevelt-era agencies, you know, the CCC, the WPA, but just remind us who they were, Stu, and the differences between these two groups, because that's important, too.
Well, CCC consisted of young, strong men from the cities who were unemployed.
The Civilian Conservation Corps.
The Civilian Conservation Corps, and they were already there in camps, and those camps are actually the basis for New Hampshire's state park system, which had been created only about 3 years earlier. And so they were there in place, there and fine. WPA had to be brought in, Works Progress Administration. It's a bigger overall organization run by Harry Hopkins, and they were another part of this picture of fixing especially the roads right away. Roads, transportation and communication were the problem. That infrastructure to some degree was in place, and that's something to think about because it's not there now. But others got into this. I mean, Dartmouth Outing Club guys got involved in stringing electric lines from the Dartmouth generator to the hospital, which didn't have any electricity.
Wow.
So the DOC boys got involved in the Hanover area. And there are all kinds of local stories about, I mean, because the towns in the end really were the ones who had to fix their problems up as best they could. And so you have all of this infrastructure, some of it in place, some of it quickly volunteering. And if you think about, and this Stephen points this out in the book, think about all these narrow roads throughout New England, not the interstates, all those trees falling down. And guess what we didn't have back then? We didn't have chainsaws. And so just imagine these crews out there with saws and axes trying to the best of their ability. There's one picture in his book which I think is fascinating. It shows this guy standing in front of enough dead trees to fill a forest, and he's got an axe in his hand.
Oh, jeez.
And you're thinking, what's this guy going to do with that little axe?
Wow. Well, it's amazing that we're not still cleaning up now. But, Stu, the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, was already in place here in New Hampshire and around the country. So these were young, probably mostly unmarried men, and they were unemployed. And this is what the government did with these guys. They said, okay, we weren't involved in World War II yet, so they were kind of the...
They would be, but
yeah.
These were military, paramilitary camps, but yeah.
So they were, from what I understand, well-organized, ready to go. The WPA was a little different. A little more controversial still?
Well, they weren't as well organized, and they were for a host of different projects. They really weren't as well trained in the area. They had to be brought into the area. And so I think that some of the locals would rather rely on the CCC boys who just threw themselves right into this. It's what they've been doing anyway. They'd already been building roads and culverts and getting involved in forestry projects, whereas the WPA was not quite as ready. And we had other things going on. I mean, we didn't have enough sawmills. We didn't have enough loggers. We didn't have enough trucks. The other day I was looking at some hurricane plates. And I thought, at first I said, what's a hurricane plate? Those were temporary license plates we gave to out-of-state loggers to come in with their trucks to help us move the logs. And if you're a real license plate collector, find yourself a hurricane plate.
That's great. I've never heard that.
Yeah, give us a little bit more there, Stephen, on the WPA. And, you know, even though the film plays heroic music and so forth, some New Englanders were skeptical of these shock troops of disaster.
Yeah, I love that term. They had a public relations problem that the CCC didn't have. I mean, these were relief programs, both of them. But the WPA, if a family needed relief, one person from that family could go. And so they tended not to be the most fit, or you know, they would hire anyone and pay regular wages. And so. So a lot of families needed relief, and so
just because it was the Great Depression, they had no one earning a salary.
Yeah, and so whoever wanted to go show up for work could show up for work, and that's the reputation is a lot of leaning on shovels and rakes, and they did a lot of good work, and I outline it in the book, but there was quite a different perception between the two.
We'll talk more after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHBR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how lessons from the hurricane of 38 might prepare us for the next big storm. We've been looking back at this enormous hurricane that did transform northern New England. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Stephen Long, author of the new book called 38, The Hurricane That Transformed New England. Stephen Long is also founder of Northern Woodlands Magazine and a former editor there. Also with us, Stuart Wallace. He's a professor of history at New Hampshire Technical Institute. One more time, your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, let's go back to the phones. And Greg's joining us from Henniker. Hi, Greg, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura. I just want to make a quick comment. My previous employment, I had the opportunity to work closely with the National Hurricane Center and other federal agencies. And it's a nice segue into the conversation you just had and just the decades of studies I did on the 38 hurricane. And that is from the emergency, what would happen today? And that's the way that we looked at it. And with the number of trees, according to the New Hampshire Forestry, the number has doubled, and there in fact, more than 100% more trees and larger trees. And I just drive around, and another 38 hurricane, I believe you're going to see people, especially rural, not being able to get out of their homes for quite some time. Power will be out for Lord knows how long. You just take a look at these white pine that line where the power lines go through. And I think people have to realize that. We love our trees, but especially around houses and down some of these roads, they probably should be removed. So,
well,
I gotta run.
Greg, thank you for calling in. And Stephen Long, you do talk about this in the book, you know, if another 38 did come through New England, what kind of shape we would be in.
Yeah, he makes a really great point. We're not only do we have more trees, larger trees, but we also have more people. We have New Hampshire has 2.5 times the number of people that it had in 1938. So the infrastructure is just there's just so much more that can be affected. And there's a lot more rural people. So people are living back in places where they weren't living in 1938, where they hadn't been living since farming time. So, you know, there's roads and power lines that are going to need to be restored, many, many more miles of them today. So we sort of feel we know a storm's coming. We have AccuWeather and telecast, great forecasting. We know all this. We feel sort of secure, and we feel like we've got our communications all set. We've got our cell phones. But all you need to do is have the power go out region-wide, and no one is going to have any communication with anyone. It is just – it's – you know, a battery-operated radio is going to be a really, really important thing.
Well, it's interesting what you say, Stephen, and Stu, I want to ask you about this too. We talked about the depopulation of northern New England farms, especially here in New Hampshire, because the farming was just never that great to begin with. But – Stephen's right. In the 60s and 70s, we saw people moving back to some of these rural New Hampshire areas. They wanted to get away from the city life.
Well, you're going to see, if you look at the areas that were hit hard by this hurricane, a lot of it is southern and southeastern and western New Hampshire. Many of those areas have exploded, maybe not to the extent, say, of Rockingham County, but the counties hit hard were not just the three western counties in New Hampshire, Sullivan, Grafton, and Cheshire, but Merrimack County, Hillsborough County were clobbered. I mean, the front lawn of the State House looked like a war zone. And so those areas will be clobbered. And all you have to do is drive around and take a look at big pine trees next to somebody's house and say, uh-oh, you know, that one just might bisect the house. And this is true. Most of our forest land today, with the exception of the National Forest, is in private hands, just somebody's front yard. So this is all there.
Well, thank you for that call. And here's a tweet that came in from a listener who says, Old Hill Village, which is now flood control area, is my favorite place in the Lakes region. Thanks, Hurricane of 38. Is this person, Stephen, talking about lakes that were created by the hurricane of 38 or flood control areas that were created by the cleanup?
I don't know specifically that one that she's referring to, but there's about 100 more flood control structures in place as a result of the 38 hurricane.
100 more?
Yeah, throughout New England. Floods were a huge part of the damage of the hurricane. We've been talking about the wind because the wind was a unique event for us. But the flood following, as Stu mentioned, the 36 and the 27 floods, we have the capacity to have really, really difficult times when it rains a lot. And so there's all these new flood control structures.
What other vestiges of the hurricane of 38 do we still see, Stu Wallace, all around us?
There are, but of course, the forest. If you can read the forest, you can see something there. But also you have vestiges. When I was a small child in the 50s, I was told one day, I was in the town of Lyme, New Hampshire, let's go play at the sawdust pile. And I thought a sawdust pile was something next to a little tiny sawmill somewhere. And there was a sawdust pile that at its base was probably better than a half acre. It was one of those, what we had to do to clean up the white pine was put them in the water. And so the state actually passed a law saying that you can load up ponds and lakes with pine because they can't lie in the ground, they'll rot. And then we basically brought in, I think at one time, something like over 300 sawmills to just saw and saw and saw. And you'd get these massive mountains of sawdust that were around for years. But even today in downtown Concord, if you go through past the Concord gas holder, and you'll notice, especially from the perspective of the interstate, it's got a cupola that's leaning. And that cupola leaning was from the 38 hurricane. It just kind of blew it off to one side.
Wait, they haven't fixed it yet?
They haven't fixed it yet. They just left it there leaning. People look at it and think, well, they didn't build it right. Well, they built it fine. It held up.
Well, it's interesting what you say about the trees being put in the lakes and ponds. And, Stephen, you talk about that in the book. I'd forgotten that there were so many trees down on the ground that you just couldn't deal with them all at once. So they chuck them in the water.
Right. So the water, as Stu suggests, would preserve them. And so the softwood, primarily pine, went into these ponds. Hardwood doesn't float, and so you would need to get at sawing that in a hurry. So around the state, there was about 300 different sites set up. Two-thirds of those were in ponds and one-third that were dry sites. And those dry sites, they had sawmills operating right off. And so the interesting thing to me is that this was a terrible, terrible event, but it put a lot of people to work. And so anybody who wanted to work could find a job. You could get a job on any of these logging crews that were developing. You could get a job at the sawmill. You know, people we mentioned already were at, you know, some of the CCC, some of the WPA. And there was all of these houses. There was infrastructure to repair. There was just a lot of work suddenly at a time when it was really important that there be a lot of work. And so a terrible, terrible event. On the other hand, there was a little bit of a silver lining.
So it put people back to work. Who paid for those people, though, to be involved in all that timber salvaging or home reconstruction and so forth? I mean, again, we're in a depression.
The Northeast Timber Salvage Administration bought logs. So if you could get a logger to deliver logs to any of these sites, you would be paid for those logs. And so that was a big source of income on that. And one thing that I think people might not know is that most of these losses were uninsured. So all of these homeowners, I mean, we just did not have homeowners insurance commonly at that time. And so all of this was was on the backs of the people who had suffered the loss. So I don't want to suggest that this was in any way a good situation for anyone. It had it had terrible, terrible minuses and some pluses to offset it.
Here's an email from Sarah who says, just a comment to salute the women who worked at the hurricane salvage sawmill at Turkey Pond. Turkey Pond is, you know, not far from our studios in Concord. And from reading your book, Steve, I learned that one of the playgrounds where I brought my kids to play when they were little, Rollins Park in Concord, had a salvage mill there.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard to imagine now.
Yeah. Well, Jim Colby, one of the people I feature in the book, talks a lot about the sawmills that his family set up. Sarah, I believe, is probably Sarah Smith at Extension, and she wrote a really wonderful book about the women at Turkey Pond called They Sawed Up a Storm. And so they were there working through the early years of World War II when the men were off in the battle. And so they operated the sawmill very, very effectively.
Well, thank you for the email, Sarah. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Susan's in Londonderry. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Yes, hi. We have a lot of apple orchards here in Londonderry, Mac farmers, Mac orchards especially. And I'm wondering whether how they weathered the storm.
Yeah, Max Apples in Londonderry. Is that the place, Susan? Am I getting that right?
That's correct.
Okay, yeah. Either of you, how did the apple trees fare? You talked about the pine trees, obviously, Stephen, and the importance of the maple industry in Vermont. What about the apple orchards? It's a good question.
It's a great question. Orchards throughout the region were hit really, really hard. And so they... I've heard stories, could be apocryphal, of people tipping apple trees back over and them being able to re-root. I have no idea whether that's a possibility. You couldn't do that with a forest tree or a yard tree, possibly a smaller tree like an apple tree. You could have. But I do know that this year's crop was all on the ground because of it and destroyed, and then the trees themselves were many of them were blown over.
Well, and you can imagine the economic hardship of people who depended on that apple crop.
Absolutely.
And the storm was September 21st, so probably the apples were just starting to, you know.
Well, one problem is the wind came from the wrong direction. Apple trees are fine with a westerly wind, but if the wind comes the other way, they will tip over. I mean, I've had to pull some back up on my property, and it's they're just not ready for that wind coming from the east or southeast. You sometimes can salvage them, and they're often exposed too. You have just a hillside of apple trees.
I never thought about that. Susan, thank you so much for the call. You know, you write in the book, Stephen Long, about how the U.S. entrance into World War II, not that many years after this storm, affected the cleanup and the recovery. So the storm's in the fall of 38, and the United States enters World War II in December of 41, so not that big a gap.
Right. And so a lot of the wood that was sawn from hurricane damage ended up, oddly enough, being repurchased by the government mostly for shipping materials, so for pallets, for crating, for dunnage, for shipping. They were shipping war material to Europe before we got into the war. And so, you know, the effort to bring material to Europe was already in place. And so a lot of the wood that was sawn ended up in the war effort.
Interesting. So we were already sending materials and supplies to Europe, and a lot of those material and supplies were put in wooden boxes from all this down timber.
Wooden boxes were a tremendous we just don't – it's hard to imagine how everything was shipped in wood at that point. We have cardboard. We have plastic. We have all sorts of things.
Metal.
Back then – it was wood. Wooden boxes, boxboard was a tremendous part of the wood economy, and anything that was shipped in a wooden box.
Our governor at the time was Francis Murphy, who began his life as a shoe nailer. He didn't touch shoes. He nailed wooden boxes. Everything was shipped in wood. We just assume that the world is plastic, styrofoam, and cardboard now. One of the biggest problems we had and that any of these states had was, what do we do with all the wood? How do we market it? How do we in New Hampshire, a guy named Owen Johnson was the point man for all of this stuff. And besides the obvious need to clean up the roads and fix communication, was how to market the wood. And we have these funny letters of his sent to all over the country saying, please buy New Hampshire wood. We have a surplus of it. And so the war comes along and actually provided a market that wasn't anticipated.
Sure, because otherwise you wouldn't have gotten hardly any money for it. Stephen describes in the book that, you know, I'm not using the right numbers, Stephen, but if you got $5 before, after all this blowdown, you might get 5 cents. So
right, yeah. And so all of this wood, the government had assumed that it was going to hold on to it for quite some time, and meter it out into the market as needed. And so they were prepared to do that, and that was all part of this salvage administration. And then it turned out that, well, there actually was a use for it much sooner than they had expected.
What do you think we've learned from the hurricane of 38, Stu Wallace?
I'm not sure we've learned anything that we should have learned, because we'd be devastated by another one just like it. And I think we have sometimes put too much reliance on our ability to predict such things as weather. But I'm not sure that we have. I think we've rebuilt where we shouldn't have rebuilt, and I think that we have not learned some of the lessons, which I hope we don't pay for.
Do you want to jump in on that, Stephen?
Yeah, I think maybe we've learned the value of public-private partnerships. I mean, it pulled us out of this really devastating economic loss, and I think that it was quite effective at solving a really huge, huge problem.
Well, and I want to acknowledge two emails that both came in on the subject of dance master Ralph Page. He wrote a dance called the Timber Salvage Reel. One emailer says, Ralph Page, originally from Nelson, a Keene, New Hampshire resident, by 1938 was a well-known dance caller, wrote a dance called the Timber Salvage Reel shortly after the hurricane, and in reference to all the timber we talked about stored in lakes and ponds. So thanks to both of those people who emailed in on that. And thanks to both of you for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Faith Mikesell, with help from Jessica Hunt. And I'm Laura Kanoy.